October 17th at 7:30 p.m. at Folinger Auditorium on the U of I Quad. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about Saudi Arabia, without a doubt one of the most powerful and most important countries in the Middle East, also one of the wealthiest by virtue of its oil reserves. Saudi Arabia has something like a quarter of the world's proven oil reserves. That makes the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States particularly important because the United States depends on oil from the Saudis, and the Saudis depend on support from the United States. It is also, among other things, a place where there is tension in recent years, it seems increasing tension, between religious conservatives and those individuals who favor modernization. In this part of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about the politics of Saudi Arabia and the relationship with the United States and how those things may or may not change with the passage of power from one ruler to another. And our guest for the program is Toby Jones. He is an analyst with the International Crisis Group. He has been with the Crisis Group since the fall of 2004. He specializes in the domestic politics and contemporary history of the Gulf states. He's written on reform and Islamism, as well as on sectarian relations in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. Right at the moment, he is finishing up his dissertation on the history of state building and Shia-Sunni relations in Saudi Arabia in the 20th century. He's at Stanford University. He has lived extensively and studied in the Middle East. He's lived in Cairo, in Riyadh, in Manama, and Amman, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. That's part of what the show is all about. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they just try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible and keep things moving along. But, of course, anybody listening is welcome to call. If you are in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, that may make it easier, maybe not, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Jones, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe just for a moment, you might talk a little bit about the International Crisis Group.
Sure. Crisis Group, sort of formerly known by its acronym ICG, is a conflict resolution organization that has field offices throughout, throughout Africa, Central Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America as well. We're a nonprofit group funded. We publicly disclose our sources of funding. We're nonpartisan and committed to crisis management, conflict resolution, and conflict prevention. We, based on extensive field work, most of our analysts who do the research and writing for our reports live in the places that they write about and offer expert analysis, but also some insight in context. We, like I said, address a number of issues in a number of different places. The group is about 10 years old, just turned 10 this year, and the profile has certainly grown considerably, and we'd like to believe that that's mostly because we do a reasonably good job of offering credible, objective as anyone can be, analysis of events on the ground and unfolding.
Oh, very good. And, of course, people who are interested in finding out more about the Crisis Group, maybe I'll just mention right up front that there is a website, and if you have Internet access, you can go to www.crisisgroup.org and see more about it. Well, let's move on to talking about Saudi Arabia, and I'm sure that there are some things that we can get into in detail, but as a kind of a general question to start out, part of our reason for talking this morning and wanting to talk with someone about Saudi Arabia was to talk about the change in the ruler in August. The man who had been the king, King Fahd, died and was succeeded by one of his brothers. His name is Abdullah, the Crown Prince Abdullah. And in some ways, it seems that this was kind of a paper change in the sense that the king had not been in good health for a number of years, and the Crown Prince essentially had been, it's my understanding, essentially had been running the government. So perhaps his now officially becoming the king, one might say that doesn't really represent much of a change, At the same time, when you read about Abdullah, he is often referred to as being someone who has some interest in change and in reform. So that might suggest that perhaps now his being king would indeed make a difference. So that's a long way of saying, how much do you think things will change as a result of Abdullah coming to the throne?
Well, that's obviously the question. Does Abdullah have more power and more credibility now as king than he did as crown prince to usher through what most people believe is his vision for a reform and modern-minded Saudi Arabia? It's a difficult question to answer. Structurally, there are challenges that he faces in the political system itself. What hasn't changed is the nature of his relationship with his other half-brothers and those people who occupy the principal positions of power within Saudi Arabia. So can he somehow tinker with, restructure, or challenge his brothers on issues of policy and politics that they don't agree with? I don't know that that has fundamentally changed. What has changed is that Abdullah is widely respected within the kingdom. He certainly has a degree of popular following that's probably unprecedented since the period of King Faisal, who was king until 1975. So Abdullah has the ability to shape public opinion, to restore, if you will, credibility to the royal family, to convince Saudi citizens that there are things that are in their interest to go along with. What those things are depend very, you know, each analyst has their own idea about what Abdullah is seriously interested in. This is a long way of answering, but saying that he can probably do some things, but expectations outside the region that he can do everything, change the system, replace a certain set of values with other values, restore or create a better set of relationships between Saudis, conservative, reform-minded, will be difficult. Sort of dealing with everything all at once is probably impossible. He needs to, and hopefully will concentrate on a number of small things that he can accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Just then to talk again in a general way about the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. It certainly is clear both the governments of both countries will say this is a very close and important relationship. At the same time, it seems clearly to be not a love match, but a marriage of convenience. And that the two countries here are dependent upon, linked and dependent upon one another. For on the one hand, we depend on the oil, and on the other hand, they depend on us to, in a sense, support them with whatever kind of influence and power that we have. It seems fairly clear that at least on our side, this is about oil. There may be more than that, and maybe slightly less clear about what it is on the Saudi side. So, again, that's sort of a long way of asking. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the two sides here in this relationship and what each side gains from it.
Well, historically, you're right. It's sort of the centerpiece of the relationship has been, from the U.S. perspective, has been access to Saudi Arabia's key natural resource, that is petroleum. For their part, Saudi Arabia has, over time, been variously interested in sort of regional and global security concerns. So the United States and the kingdom, since the 1940s, have essentially agreed, whether it's a bargain or a relationship of convenience, on this exchange of security for access to oil. That is essentially unchanged. I think that the United States obviously is still concerned about oil. There are all kinds of global questions about global changes, sort of the nature of relationships that Saudi Arabia has with other oil-consuming states and how the United States will fit into that into the future. The U.S. is still concerned primarily with having access. Saudi Arabia is still concerned about its security. Recent comments by the foreign minister, Saud al-Faisal, about Iran reemerging as a regional power, sort of speak to Saudi Arabia's continuing concerns and the hope that the United States can, they certainly do hope that the United States will continue to play a role in preserving Saudi Arabia's preeminence in the region. One thing that's changed, particularly since 9/11, is the question of security from the perspective of the United States. Saudi Arabia has not only been a consumer of security, it's also participated widely in U.S. security and sort of efforts to contain communism. Obviously, the Afghan jihad is the most obvious example where the United States depended on Saudi Arabia to not only sponsor, but also to help recruit, to send people to support, both financial and actual personnel into the battlefield, if you will. But Saudi Arabia also helped in financing efforts elsewhere. What's changed in that is that the United States, obviously since 9/11, Saudi domestic politics has become a security concern. So that's a new part of the equation that I don't think the U.S. had to deal with previously, nor did Saudi Arabia for that matter. But it's certainly on the table now and probably accounts more than anything else for the strain in the relationship.
Mm. Certainly, I'm sure there are people here in the United States who would say that this relationship is important because of the oil, but it's also important because the United States doesn't really have that many friends in the region, in the Middle East, and we need all the friends that we can get. I think having said that, though, there are people that will suggest some sort of misgivings to some degree or another that, in fact, that there are people in Saudi Arabia, and perhaps even people in the government of Saudi Arabia, that in fact are working against U.S. interests as we see them. Is that in fact the case, or to what extent is that the case?
I think that there's probably some credibility to that kind of analysis. Certainly Saudis don't necessarily see their interests as coinciding completely with that of the United States. Saudi Arabia and its citizens have voiced concerns for a number of years now about other issues both in the region and globally, whether it has to do with Islam more generally or with political conflicts like the Arab-Israeli conflict, that diverge considerably, starkly, from what the U.S. agenda in the region is. The question of whether or not there are members or powerful elements of the Saudi political system that are actively working to undermine U.S. interests in the region and elsewhere is a difficult one to answer. I don't happen to personally believe that there are people sitting around in various ministries believing that they're fighting against the United States, either globally or regionally. I think at a lower level, perhaps within sort of ministries and bureaucracies at mid-management level, within other organizations inside Saudi Arabia, some charities, for example, they probably are actively pursuing this sort of confrontation. We've heard a lot of talk about this over the last 4 years, the role that non-government organizations inside Saudi Arabia play. I think that they probably are. They do see themselves as antagonistic toward the United States and its role in the world.
In this hour of Focus 580, we're talking with Toby Jones. He is an analyst with the International Crisis Group. This is, as we explained at the beginning of the program, it's a non-governmental, non-profit organization. It's based in, the headquarters are in Brussels, but they have offices all over the world, and they are interested in trying to prevent and resolve conflict by doing research and advocacy and then providing that information to anyone who is interested in having it. Our guest here, Toby Jones, his specialty is domestic politics and contemporary history of the Gulf states. And we are talking this morning about Saudi Arabia. Questions are welcome. We have someone ready to go, and others who are listening are certainly invited. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. The first caller here to start us off is in Indiana on our toll-free line, which is line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two general questions. One, being in the United States, basically all we hear is about our relationship with Saudi Arabia and all the different meanings that adds to different analysts. I was wondering if you could talk somewhat about other countries' relation to Saudi Arabia, sort of in the same general sense, what their politicals would be saying about their situation in regards to Saudi Arabia. And second question deals with Iran, I guess. I presume there's some difference of opinion between the two countries, mainly because it may be different Muslim sects. Or exactly what is it? Is it oil against oil, or two different countries feeling their Wheaties and want to make sure that they control what's actually going on in that region itself? Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead, and you can respond to those questions however you'd like.
Well, the first question is an interesting one. I think that's correct, that we often don't have perspective on what other countries in the region and outside have in Saudi Arabia. It's not altogether different from the United States, of course. Saudi Arabia provides a considerable amount of oil, both to East Asia, China, and Japan, as well as the European Union. So those countries also have an interest in maintaining a relationship with Saudi Arabia and the GCC countries more generally, the other countries in the Gulf who make up a cooperation council. But there are other elements to this as well, some having to do with security, others having to do with access to markets. For example, listeners may be aware of a recent scandal that was disclosed in an English newspaper about arms purchases in exchange for political favors, where the Saudis had agreed to purchase so many billions of dollars worth of military hardware from the UK in exchange for movement on some issues of political concern, particularly the deportation of some political dissidents who live in London currently. There are a number of issues that frame sort of Western countries' relationships: oil, security, access to arms markets. Saudi Arabia is quite possibly the largest consumer of weapons, aside from the United States, on the planet. But there are also regional concerns. There are traditional or historical rivalries, rather, between Egypt and Saudi Arabia, for example, countries who compete for preeminence politically in the region, who seek to shape both the agenda and future of the Arab League, the Arab states' commitment or direction on Palestine, for example, and increasingly on Iraq. The second question about the differences between Iran and Saudi Arabia, clearly the most important difference, the most obvious difference, is this question of sect. Iran is predominantly Shia. Saudi Arabia is predominantly Sunni. That certainly on the surface seems to be the most important difference. But really in its historical context, relations between the two states worsened only in 1975, or they grew poor in 1979, rather, with the Islamic Revolution, the rise of Khomeini, his very charismatic stand on exporting the Islamic Revolution, and specifically targeting Sunni regimes in the region, particularly Sunni regimes like Saudi Arabia that have a large Shia minority. So Iran's attempt to sort of carve out for itself influence both in the Persian Gulf and also in Central Asia. Keep in mind that Afghanistan is on the eastern side of Iran, and should it have in the 1980s extended its influence that far, Saudi Arabia was greatly concerned about that as well. So the rivalry is probably more political and more geostrategic than it is based on religion. But as sort of we're seeing today in Iraq as well, that religious difference is often convenient language to talk about political differences and rivalries. So religion matters, but I don't think it's at the heart of the matter.
Well, it seems that when you take a look at the region, if you ask the question, what countries seem to have the potential in terms of size, power, influence, resources to dominate or at least be significant players and thus to struggle with each other for a kind of dominance, it would have to think that that Iran and Saudi Arabia would be at the top of the list, and that Iraq would figure in there somehow, or at least it seemed the United States at one time had this idea that it could, that Iraq perhaps, in terms of oil, if for no other reason, could be an important, powerful country in the region and our friend. Now there's some question about whether that would, when that would be the case, or if that would ever be the case. But It's if you ask, well, who are likely to be the most powerful players, and for that reason, be elbowing each other? It seems that that those are the two: Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Right. Absolutely. I think it's sort of 2 years, 2.5 years after the invasion of Iraq, things have obviously not worked out the way that the United States had hoped. But sort of the political consequences, particularly the unintended consequences of the invasion and the subsequent military occupation, are that you can argue this, that the United States does not have a safe foothold in Iraq. It's an unstable situation where the United States cannot exercise the kind of regional influence that it had hoped, and what it's done is probably actually weakened U.S. hegemony in the Gulf. That makes Saudi Arabia very nervous, if for no other reason than its natural allies, if you will, in Iraq are the minority, Sunni Arabs who live in Baghdad and northwest and west of there. Iran, on the other hand, sees the situation, particularly the weakened U.S. position there, as an opportunity to exert its influence. Now, whether or not it's successfully doing so is something that's contested, depending on who you ask. Does Iran have a role in Iraq? It's unclear. I think that they do, but it's unclear to the extent to which they do. But they clearly see an opportunity. I think the nuclear gamble of this sort of the pursuit of nuclear power, peaceful or otherwise, is certainly an example of Iran's feeling very much emboldened in the region. And that certainly wasn't anticipated. In fact, it was expected that it would be quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else. This is someone listening this morning in White Heath, and they are on line one. Hello.
Hello. I was just going to call about the religious influences that are going on over there, too, and I guess you've sort of basically answered that about the rise of the Shia over in Iraq and how that's going to play out, you know, with the Sunni Saudi Arabians and the Shia Iranians, and I guess it's a big mess, so I don't know. I'll just listen off the air, because I guess you basically have answered that question already. Thanks.
Well, let me ask you to maybe take it a little further, or perhaps talk about something that is related but a little bit different, and I know it's something that you're interested in and have done research on. As you have mentioned, most of the Muslims in Saudi Arabia are Sunnis, but there are Shia there. And a minority, what's life like for Saudi Shiites? And is there any potential there for conflict, or are their numbers small enough so that that's not really an issue?
Well, the Shia probably number in a total population of about 16.5 million Saudi citizens. The population of Saudi Arabia is considerably larger than that because it has between 6 and 8 million foreign workers. But out of a 16.5 million indigenous population, 2%, 10 to 15% of that is Shia, so somewhere around 1.5 to 2 million people who live in different parts of the kingdom. But by and large, they're concentrated in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, which also happens to be the most strategically important and vulnerable part of the kingdom because that's where the oil is. Now, life for the Shia has been difficult. I think everybody would agree that Saudi Arabia adheres to quite possibly the most strict and austere variant of Islam that's interpreted in the region today, and that takes a particularly dim view of Shiites in particular. There's an easy list of things you can go down and say these are important ulama or clerics in Saudi Arabia who have said these nasty things about the Shia. So the Shia in Saudi Arabia live in this kind of the sea of hostility, if you will. Now that hasn't always manifested, or it hasn't really manifested in widespread violence against them in the 20th century. Although the state has practiced various forms of oppressive political tactics, they're mostly marginalized from the political system. They're not represented in any kind of a proportional number. They're also excluded from most of the largesse of oil revenues. They don't really have access to any kind of wealth, although there are individual wealthy merchants. So it's a hard life for Shia. The Iraq War, which has emboldened Shiites in Iraq and certainly given rise to what looks like will be a Shia-dominated political system, has produced two effects inside Saudi Arabia. One, it has emboldened some who are responding to what they perceive to be a historic opportunity. It has made others more nervous, and the reason that others are nervous is that since the mid-1990s, the Shia in Saudi Arabia have had a calm, sort of quiet, productive political relationship with the government. They've sort of sought mutual ways to improve the lot of Shia and to end Shia political dissidents. So there's two trends now. One is these people who want to continue to pursue reconciliation or inclusion, and others who see Iraq as an opportunity and who would very much sort of agitate for a more confrontational political line against the central government. Certainly complicated the situation in a number of ways.
We are at our midpoint here in this part of Focus, and I should introduce again the guest, Toby Jones. He's an analyst with the International Crisis Group. This is a nonprofit. It's a non-governmental organization. It is headquartered in Brussels, but has offices all around the world. And it is interested through doing analysis and research to try to prevent and resolve conflict, and then make their expertise available to anybody who is interested in it. If you would like to find out more about the Crisis Group, they do have a website that will tell you about them and will also give you information on some of their programs and on media releases and so forth. And that is crisisgroup.org. Toby Jones has been with the Crisis Group since October 2004. His area of interest and expertise is domestic politics and contemporary history of the Gulf states. And he has written on reform and Islamism, also on sectarian relations in Saudi Arabia and in Bahrain. Right at the moment, he's finishing up his dissertation at Stanford, writing on the history of state building and Shia-Sunni relations in Saudi Arabia in the 20th century. And he has lived in the Middle East and studied there extensively. He's lived in Cairo and Riyadh in Jordan. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Back sort of at the beginning where we were talking kind of generally about the new king, King Abdullah, formerly the crown prince, and the fact that he is often said to be someone who has some sympathy for reform. You said at the same time in the Saudi context, this would be very difficult because there are a number of people who have some sort of grasp and claim on power. And certainly there are forces in the country that are not interested in modernization. Within the Saudi context, when someone talks about modernization, what exactly is one talking about, and what sort of changes might the king be able to make or be interested in making, small but at least significant?
What people are pursuing, particularly a group of, and when we talk about reform, for example, in Saudi Arabia, I mean, it's important to clarify that there are a number of different people with a number of different interests, sometimes competing, that all have differing or contrasting, if you will, versions on what reform means. So there are Islamic scholars who think reform means a theocracy driven by or dominated by the clergy versus what we might put in quotes, liberal reformers who have a different perspective on what reform means. So for one word, there's a lot of different ideas about what it can mean. Abdullah seems to fall into the latter camp. And the people who, since 2003 in Saudi Arabia, who have advocated publicly for reform, are talking specifically about a basic set of issues. And they're familiar to us. Freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, in addition to a number of institutional changes. What they'd like is more transparency within the government, accountability to elected members of government, whether it be a national parliament or local bodies, municipal or regional councils, and the separation of powers between Saudi Arabia's judiciary and the royal family, which is essentially the executive, legislative, and judicial branch all bound up into one. I think that these are not unfamiliar. And what Saudi reformers have a hard time doing, largely because they have such a big hill to climb, is advocating a specific outline policy approach to how this might look. So for now, what it means is that people are calling for these basic sets of rights to be guaranteed in some kind of political contract, whether that be a constitution or something else, as well as institutional changes. Abdullah seems less interested, perhaps less capable, of pulling off the serious institutional changes, because those would threaten his brothers and other competitors for power. What he's more interested in are making the kinds of value-based changes. He's certainly interested in loosening restrictions on the press. He's intervened in instances in the past to diminish or mitigate punishment against journalists who have, according to some, gone too far. He's also interested in stimulating economic reform, which seems to be outside of his political context. And that's the main critique against Abdullah, is that he's interested in social and economic reform, but not so much in the political issues. There are competing visions, but even within this sort of quote-unquote liberal reform community of which Abdullah is part, there are different ideas about where the emphasis should be.
In some of the things that I have read, the point has been made more than once that, or for example, in one story, kind of analysis background piece, pointed out that Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world that's named for its ruling family, and that there the man. The man who was the first ruler, and then thereafter his sons have been the ones to hold the reins of power, and they have been closely held. And the question is, sort of the big question is, what's the long-term longevity of such a system? Can it continue? And particularly once we get into the next generation, where the number of people who perhaps would have some claim on power will increase dramatically. There are enough people now. They will be even more, and it won't be that far into the future. How does such a system manage to continue to function?
Well, that's certainly a key question for people who watch succession battles in Saudi Arabia, who speculate about it, believe that this is the fundamental challenge that the kingdom faces over the next 10 to 15 years. That is, the passing of power from the founding monarch's sons, Abdulaziz's sons, of whom Abdullah is part, the previous king, Fahd, of course, was an older brother of his, to their children's generation, so the grandchildren of the founding monarch. And this is a difficult question to answer. Political power is distributed amongst various ministries and organizations. And each brother of Abdullah has an interest in seeing his own son positioned close to the throne. I'm not surprised that the transition to Abdullah was a relatively smooth one. That's not where the political contest is going to come into play. The challenge is going to be who's not after Abdullah, because that's already been established as well, but who's the next generation? And it's a difficult question. It's not clear who's going to fill that role at this point. If the royal family knows, they're certainly not disclosing it. It would be impossible to speculate about what particular figure it could be. But in as much as we'd like to... People in this country like to point out that this is a certainly a potential point of instability in the kingdom. Miss out that Saudi Arabia's royal family manages to maintain and manage its interests and has done so successfully in spite of serious political challenges and rivalries within. They've managed various transitions to power without, sometimes of course, the 1950s and 60s with fireworks, but really never at a point where they threatened to either disintegrate or dissolve or lose their total grip on the country. So I'm not necessarily convinced that they face a long-term crisis here. I think what's possible is that they will continue to lose credibility over the long term, popularly, but it's difficult to speculate about.
Mm-hmm. Do I have it correct that the next person now in line after Abdullah is Prince Naif, and someone who has the reputation in the way that Abdullah has a reputation of being somewhat in reform-minded, that Naif is seen as being significantly less reform-minded and more conservative?
Next in line is Sultan, who's the crown prince, who has mostly moderate views on reform. Naif is certainly one of the other key candidates for the third in power position, which has not been named yet. That's gone unfilled over the last several months, which is not a historical anomaly in Saudi Arabia. For the most part, it's taken quite a bit of time for sort of the second successor to the throne to be named, and that's clearly part of some internal management process. On the question of Naif as a character, certainly based on his public comments on 9/11, and his role as Minister of the Interior, where he manages the domestic police forces and the intelligence services, he's seen as a very conservative figure who's close to the most controversial and most conservative. And some say he's closer to the jihadist networks than anybody else. He's not seen as a reformer. I think he's a political operator who has a constituency that he appeals to. I don't know that he necessarily has a coherent line on reform, but he's certainly the antithesis in a lot of ways to Abdullah.
Given the fact that the Saudi political system is such a closed system, it's the equivalent of a family owned company that's not publicly traded. That doesn't have to disclose its. It doesn't have to open its books to anybody. Does that make it difficult? Is it a great challenge to try to understand the dynamics of Saudi politics?
It does, certainly, particularly the internal dynamics of within the royal family itself. There are things we can understand. An important part of the system is this historical relationship between the clergy and the ruling family. I mean, there's a partnership that's been put in place where the royal family concedes power over cultural, religious, and social matters to a high-ranking body of clerics that descend from, you know, this sort of one line, this one family that dates back several centuries, in exchange for political power and popular credibility. That's a part of the Saudi political system that we can analyze and we can understand, because interaction is, it usually takes place more publicly, and the clerics have a public role to play in legitimizing policy. It's the internal dynamics of the royal family that are difficult to understand. It's not impossible to predict the way certain members are going to act. And they have various ministries and various functions and have increasingly over the last 5 to 10 years even played more of a public role and made their decision, their logic more clear in the public sphere. And so we sort of have an opportunity, have recently had a better opportunity to understand the way the internal dynamic works. But that other dynamic, that other relationship is, I think, also one that captures quite a bit of attention here and that's not widely understood that we can analyze in more detail.
We have a couple of callers here to bring in. So let's do that, starting with Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I apologize I missed the first part of the show, but I don't think you've covered this, but I've heard it characterized that there are actually two major factional military camps in Saudi Arabia, and that they're being played off against each other by the House of Saud and by outside actors such as the U.S. I'm wondering whether you buy that and whether you can outline it. If you don't buy it, maybe you could still outline it. But I'm also curious about what's been called the executive mercenaries, and this is this Vanel Corporation that the U.S. has approved to go in and train perhaps one side or the other, or maybe both, I'm not sure. So U.S. influence, there's a lot of things said about the Bush family connections to the House of Saud, and actually this FBI expose sort of thing where, Free says he got more cooperation from the Saudis after going to ex-President Bush 1 than when Clinton was asking. That was just kind of a postscript. I don't know if you really want to deal
right
with that kind of thing as an allegation, but the whole structure of the military state as sort of two opposing camps. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Well, certainly there are rival factions. The Saudi military system is carved up into different pieces. The National Guard is presided over by Abdullah and is largely seen as a royal guard for domestic situations. So, for example, in 1979, there were two separate instances in the fall of that year. One, a band of Sunni, very conservative Salafi rebels occupied the mosque in Mecca. They were rooted out by Saudi special forces, and I believe the National Guard, although most of our information on that is really unclear. The other episode was the Shia rose up in 1979 for a number of reasons, galvanized in part by sort of what was happening in Iran at the time, but certainly for domestic reasons as well. And they were basically confronted by the National Guard. So for domestic security issues, there's this military wing that handles those situations. Institutionally, organizationally, in terms of its chain of authority and power, it's separate from the Saudi Defense Services, which is presided over by the Crown Prince, Sultan, who's also the Minister of Defense and the Crown Prince. So, and in a lot of ways, these institutions, and the caller is exactly right, these are rival. They can be seen as, to put it most crudely, they can be seen as the personal militias of independent princes who have an interest in maintaining their own position and power. So if Abdullah is the head of the National Guard and Sultan is the head of the Defense Services, if they have rival interests, they command a different branch of the military. And theoretically, there's the possibility that a rivalry exists there. I won't say for certain that I believe that there is. I think they're more coordinated, and sort of those days have passed where princes were gonna fight it out with national services. In terms of the U.S. interest in training individual elements of this, certainly Vanel has a role in training the National Guard, but the U.S. is also heavily involved with the Ministry of Defense in providing all kinds of arms and munitions that go to different institutions. So I think the U.S. has played a pretty big role in supplying just about everybody, and maybe that does support the thesis that they just are playing rival factions off against one another, although I'm really not in a position to know. I don't have contacts in that network.
Other questions are welcome. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Toby Jones. He is an analyst with the International Crisis Group and specializes in the domestic politics and contemporary history of the Gulf states. We're talking about Saudi Arabia. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you could talk about what sort of opposition to the regime there is in the country, some of it is militant and Islamist, clearly. Is there a kind of secular democratic opposition to the ruling family and who advocate to one extent or another some kind of political change and reform?
Well, certainly the most powerful sort of political communities. It's almost difficult at this point to call them opposition groups for reasons that I would be happy to go into. And in fact, the elections played a very interesting role. Both elections and the handling of reform have played a very important role in bringing almost everybody into the royal family camp. In a lot of ways, reform has consolidated the central authority of the Al Saud. But in terms of the various factions that make up political communities or groupings within the kingdom, the largest is Islamist. It's got a number of different stripes, if you will. There are conservatives who, as I said previously, are interested in creating a theocracy. There are more progressive Islamists who are committed to the kinds of institutional changes that would call for the separation of power and greater freedom of expression and assembly and those sorts of things. Secularists do exist in Saudi Arabia, and they're not insignificant. But politically, their ability to maneuver publicly and to sort of advocate is circumscribed by what they perceive to be a largely conservative Saudi society. So on the one hand, sort of at the starting gate, their ability or their perception that they have the ability to move publicly or to move public opinion is limited. As a result, what they've done strategically is they've aligned themselves with moderate Islamist forces in order to create a kind of broad centrist coalition of Islamist and secular slash liberal powerful Saudis who, as a united front, believe that they can appeal across a broader spectrum of Saudi society. But increasingly, if we take 2003 as the critical year, in January of 2003, then Crown Prince Abdullah received an important petition calling for a series of reforms that was very secular in its language and wording. By the end of the year, the signatories of these petitions had changed quite considerably. They included a larger number of clerics and Islamic scholars. And the language had as well. It had moved further to the right, to use our political spectrum. It had become more religious and spoke in more Islamist language. And I think that that was upsetting to quite a few liberals and secular-minded folks in Saudi Arabia, but was largely seen as the best way to achieve a kind of popular consensus in the kingdom. So reform has tended toward the Islamist line. Increasingly over the last 2 years.
Well, let me ask you then let me pick up on something that you said as a preface to your comments, where you said within Saudi Arabia there are some powerful political communities, but for some reasons that I'm sure that you can amplify on, you cannot really consider them to be, in quotes, an opposition.
Right. Well, the argument is this, and the government actually plays it quite well. I mean, it's really masterful on the part of the royal family, the way they can both dominate Western analysis about the situation in the kingdom, but also how it can frame local political activism. And what the royal family says, and certainly what is the dominant political narrative, is that the royal family would like to be more progressive. It would like to institute reform quickly. And it's come to this position after a couple of years of reluctance. But the reason it says it can't move forward is that Saudi Arabia is inherently conservative, and that the people who really control the streets are clerics who borderline on the radical, that the government can't really control, and that if it threatened their power, would quite possibly lead to civil unrest. And, all of the sort of abstracted conclusions from that there would be more radicalism, more jihadis, that sort of thing. The reform-minded Islamists and liberals in Saudi Arabia largely believe the same thing to be true. So there are two camps. within reformist circles, one committed to political reform and another committed to social reform. And by social reform, they mean curtailing the power of the clergy. The social reformers were in a minority position 2 years ago. They're now ascendant. And they largely repackage and distribute the government line, that the real battle is a battle of ideas to be fought between the clergy and the rest of Saudi society, and that political reforms will come later. Now, at the same time that Saudi Arabia's kingdom sort of rulers have dictated this change over the last couple of years, what they've also done is they've cultivated new kinds of relationships with the clergy at the same time. So the kingdom has sort of domestically positioned itself to be in both camps at the same time, and so working in the other direction, both the clergy and the reformers are brought into the fold, and each perceive themselves to be the strongest allies of the central government and these key princes. So it's tenuous, and you know, on the surface it seems inherently contradictory, but because the ability for groups to compete in public is so limited, there's no real competition or real danger that this will break down anytime soon. The government comes out all the stronger for it, and these groups are competing against one another by trying to become even closer to the royal family.
Well, it certainly seems, I don't know if this is overly cynical, but it seems very convenient for the royal family to be able to say, look, we're really interested in reform, but you have to be very careful because there are people within Saudi society that are not, and if we push them too far, if we threaten their power base, there could be real conflict. So that gives the Saudi royal family a very convenient excuse or justification to go slow on reform if they go at all.
Well, to her credit, and I think cynical is exactly the right sort of way of describing what our position, what everybody's position should be about this, including Saudis themselves. But to her credit, Gandhi Rice, the Secretary of State, called the Saudis on this earlier in the summer and said, you know, she doesn't necessarily believe that this potential conflict is as sharp, or the divisions are as sharp as the government is saying that it is. And I happen to agree with her. And agree that a cynical approach to this is the right one. I think that the kingdom is overstating the severity of the threat, but for clear political reasons. I mean, their interests are in not giving up political power. As much as they talk about reform and have co-opted the language of reform, what they're really interested in doing is maintaining their own grip on things. And it doesn't matter what you call it. You call it a democracy. As long as they still run the show, they're quite happy with that. So they certainly, I believe, are using this as political leverage. But it's political leverage, citing this possible threat, that has some teeth to it. As they can point to 9/11, in as much as 15 of the 19 hijackers being Saudi created problems for them, in a way it can now be turned back around and said, look, I mean, this is evidence that we're dealing with a serious domestic issue, that they can then repackage and justify a very slow approach to reform.
Let's talk with another caller here, someone in Urbana, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I just had two quick questions. I didn't catch if you talked about it, whether or not you described what our presence, military presence in Saudi Arabia is. And then number two, and I'll hang up after this, I was wondering if you could, you had anything much to say about Saudi Arabia's ability to realign its finances to the euro instead of the dollar. I'll hang up, thanks.
Okay.
On the first issue, the U.S., as far as I know, has mostly drawn down its military presence in the kingdom. There are clear indications that it did use basing, Air Force basing, in the early part of the Iraq War, but has mostly relocated its military forces to either Kuwait or Qatar or the Arab Emirates. It's still an issue. I mean, the U.S. military role in the region, which has always been a source of conflict, and even dating back to the 1950s and 1960s, has been a source of irritation for a lot of Saudis, even though the Americans have now withdrawn however many tens of thousands of people they had there after the first Gulf War. It's still a source of frustration for a lot of Saudis that the U.S. has a role in the region. But as far as I know, in terms of actual numbers, the U.S. military presence has been almost completely removed. In terms of realigning its the kingdom realigning its finances with to the euro, that's certainly I believe a concern. I don't think there's genuine interest in Saudi Arabia, and for this reason, I think, most specifically, and that is that in as much as the euro might empower Saudi Arabia financially, the kingdom still perceives itself and is, in fact, strategically vulnerable in the region. And the EU cannot play a military role in the Gulf. It doesn't have either the infrastructure, the capacity, or the political will to deploy thousands of troops to the region. So Saudi Arabia understands this. If it was to do something so dramatic as to realign itself with the euro and upset the Americans, it would then be vulnerable to other regional threats, whether that be Egypt or Iran or a reconfigured Iraq. So I don't see it going down that road.
Well, how important is the relationship between between Saudi Arabia and Europe? Or are there particular countries in Europe where the relationship is anything like that between the Saudis and the United States?
I think the two largest sort of benefactors in Europe are France and England. The UK both maintain, hope to maintain, large arms relationships as well. But sort of politically, beyond that sort of security, you know, kind of both the financial and political implications that come along with that, the EU has a growing interest in the region. The EU has mostly been, I mean, it's kind of the supra-European organization, has had an interest in the Middle East and in reform and democracy, but it's largely been confined to the Mediterranean region, the Barcelona process. But that expires, I think, in March of 2006, and indications are that the EU is going to expand its interest politically to the Persian Gulf itself. So there have been discussions between the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, and the EU about creating free trade zones, free trade agreement, expanding cooperation on political and other kinds of issues. So there are early signs that the EU is more interested, which indicates all kinds of things. It indicates, again, perhaps the weakening of U.S. hegemony in the region, but also recognizing that this is quite possibly the most important strategic place on the planet because it has the most oil. Mm.
Well, there we'll have to leave it for right now because we're here at the end of the time. Our thanks to our guest, Toby Jones. He is an analyst with the International Crisis Group, specializes in domestic politics and contemporary history of the Gulf states. If you're interested in finding out more about the Crisis Group, you can seek out their website. It's www.crisisgroup.org. Mr. Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from the University of Illinois Office of the Chancellor, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at ccfd.uiuc.edu. The program today also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. We're going to break for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety.